You're listening to a program from the Aloud Archives. Aloud is a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the LA Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud.
Of all the book reviewers with whom I've worked in my years as an editor, Ivan Doig turned in the cleanest copy. I didn't have to change a word of his lyrical prose, only write a sentence to identify him and then essentially spirit his review off to the printing presses. But boy, writing that one sentence for Ivan Doig proved no mean feat, for I had to go on what were his publisher's blurbs, and frankly, I found them bewildering. I remember back in 1992 reading one such description that began, "A ranch hand and magazine editor." Now, a ranch hand and a magazine editor. I mean, now how can a man tend cattle and horses on the range and battle rush hour traffic in midtown Manhattan at the same time? Well, the author blurb went on, "Doig is a master of the modern Western." Okay, now I'm really getting muddle-headed and fuddle-brained. Wasn't the West that dusty frontier street on which Gary Cooper and Ian McDonald duked it out at high noon? Isn't the Western, by definition, old? That same perplexity came back to me, deja vu, a few weeks ago when I cracked open Ivan's latest book, Bucking the Sun. It's set in Montana, which my little city boy mind thinks of as a land of serious antisocial types, like the Freeman, holed up there in their compound and not planning to come out, thank you very much. Not to mention hardcore loners like the Unabomber. Fortunately, there was something in the book to keep me in my saddle, something familiar to me. And that was a kind of energy and dynamic can-do spirit that I think of as particularly pronounced in the West. Listen to Hugh Duff, the patriarch of Ivan's latest novel, giddy with pride after his wife has given birth to twins. "This was family founding, with no doubt about it, Hugh Duff style, Missouri River style. He and his would fill this valley before they were done, work this fresh Nile to a perfection." Listen also to farmer Hugh Duff after he gives birth to a bumper year of crops. "When you got it right, learning to live with one year's rainfall and the next year's lack of it, figuring out the pattern of yield hidden in the soil, and the splendid alfalfa sprang into gallant green and bursting purple, which led at last to this harvest of the valuable buckshot-sized seeds, this was as close as Hugh Duff could come to prayer." Finally, listen to Ivan's description of Hugh's son, Owen, a civil engineer in charge of designing the Fort Peck Dam, a massive New Deal project wherein over 123 million cubic tons of dirt are dumped in an attempt to halt the furious flow of the Missouri River. Complicated didn't even begin to say it about this showcased project of the New Deal, this fever time of history. And he absolutely damn loved it, the jigsaw excitement that had swept in with Roosevelt's inauguration, the alphabet agencies, the economic pump priming. It was already legend that the chief engineer of the Corps had not even signed off on the Fort Peck Dam before the Public Works Administration had started funding it. In other words, the Fort Peck Dam and the other WPA projects like it were to the 1930s sort of what the moonshots were to the 1960s. We may have been unable to strip away the misery of the economic depression, but hell, we could surely try to stop the Great Missouri. We may not have been able to control corruption or the Cold War in the 1960s, but hell, with enough cojones, we could send a man to the moon. The question remains, though, how lasting really are these accomplishments? Are we making history or repeating it? Ivan's latest novel, for all its brilliant evocation of hope and hubris, leaves us wondering, for something goes wrong for Hugh and Owen, and most of the novel's other characters. Something, as Ivan puts it, ambushes all hopes. So, is the West a promising place or a dangerous one? Is it a place where dreams come true or fears come realized? I think Ivan's saying that it's both. The West, like other relatively young and callow cultures, is a place where the edge between hope and bluster on this side and loneliness and disappointment on this side is particularly sharp. Perhaps that's why Ivan dedicates Bucking the Sun to writers like South Africa's Nadine Gordimer and Australia's Tim Winton, who, he says, deliver the eloquence of the edge of the world. Is that a good place for us to be in as we approach the millennium? I don't know. I guess we'll have to find out in the discussion section. But as you'll hear in Ivan's reading, the edge is most definitely a good place for a writer or any gifted artist to be. Willem de Kooning, the abstract expressionist painter who died last week, explained it best after being asked, "What's your secret?" He said, "You have to keep on the very edge of something, or the picture dies." Gentlewomen and men, a most lyrical writer from the edge, Ivan Doig.
Thanks very much, Alex. Since we're in this millennial series, I thought I'd give you two turns of the century for the price of one in today's reading. Two pieces of reading. One will be some new stuff, work in progress, as pages lacking final polish are so grandly called. A novel to be published in 1999. But before that, I thought I'd read a scene from just before the turn of this century, from my novel of 19th century America comers, Homesteaders to the American West, the novel Dancing at the Rascal Fair. A bit of setting the stage for you for Rascal Fair. The narrator is Angus McCaskill, a young homesteader in an area of northern Montana, area tucked under the Rocky Mountain front along English Creek, as I've renamed the geography there. Angus and the other settlers in the valley are highly Scottish, so much so that the valley has been nicknamed Scotch Heaven. Angus, at this point in his life, is also the school teacher in the one-room school on the South Fork of English Creek. And he is also suddenly, helplessly, head over boot heels in love with the new teacher in the next valley over on Noon Creek, a gorgeous newcomer, fortuitously Scotch, named Anna Ramsey. The scene I'll read is the beginning of Angus and Anna's courtship and a Saturday night dance in Angus's schoolhouse. The other main names you will hear, besides their two, are Rob Barkley, Angus's lifelong friend whom he emigrated from Scotland with, Rob's wife Judith, only briefly mentioned here, and Lucas Barkley, Rob's uncle, rather the patriarch of this book, and to Angus and Rob as well. Lucas has helped finance them in their homesteads and the sheep business and so on. And lastly, a bit of a wild card, a mention of a character back in Scotland named Fergus the Dervish. Fergus was a Highlands dancer. The McCaskills and Barclays are proudly Lowlanders from an area not too far from Dundee, but their town of Nethermuir, which incidentally I made up, Nethermuir had an annual gathering called the Rascal Fair, where the most stubborn or hard to get along with farmers and farm workers would meet for a day. There'd be drink, dancing, arguing. They would bargain out the terms of employment and summer wages. It'd be rather as if the Los Angeles Times classified ads had a section headed Bozos Looking for Work and SOBs Offering Jobs. Well, at the Nethermuir version, the Rascal Fair, part of the entertainment was this itinerant Highland dancer who was so fervent and animated that he was called Fergus the Dervish, as, of course, in Whirling Dervish. As you will hear, the memory of him is a bit of inspiration to our narrator, Angus. This night of nights, Saturday night dance in his schoolhouse. The dance scene has begun, is beginning here, as people are gathering and gathering. They're coming by horseback and wagon. It's a few years before the turn of the century. They're coming from miles around. And Angus is proud and ecstatic at the turnout. Angus's voice now. By the holy, I love these people. This night, I loved all of Scotch Heaven, the Two Medicine Country, Montana, America, the sky over and the earth under. Who could not? What I love strongest of all entered now through my schoolroom doorway in a dark blue skirt and white shirt waist and an ivory brooch at her throat. Anna and her mother and father, surprisingly unprepossessing for a pair who had given mankind such a gift. And others from Noon Creek, the Wainwrights and Egan's, all come in one wagon and now entering our tuneful school, eager for the reward of that ride. The dance begins in the book with various tunes played by the fiddler. Things are really warming up. The floor is starting to bounce. Leading up to this. So spirited was the dancing to Brig of Dee that it made Thad Wainwright come by and announce, Angus and Rob, I got to hand it to you. You Scotchmen sure do know how to make feet move. Only one thing missing from tonight, as far as I can tell. How come no bagpipes? Lord of mercy, when was the rest of humankind going to quit thinking of us as wild Highlanders? A soul of moderation, I only told Thad. Thad, we thought there's enough wind in this country without making any more. It's kind of disappointing, though, you know, Thad went on. With all you Scotchmen here under one roof, the rest of us figured we're going to see some real flinging. The Noon Creek rancher chuckled a regret and moved on. Moon and star, fire and air, choose your mate and make a pair, dancing at the rascal fair. My verse on the blackboard spoke aloud to me over Thad's retreating shoulder. It made me remember aloud to Rob. Fergus the dervish. Rob roared a laugh. Fergus and his Highland hoops. Hit your old Thad some steps. Rob, why don't we? The two of us saw Fergus enough times at the rascal fair. You think we can? Man, is there something we can't do? We haven't found it yet, have we? Rob agreed. You're right, you're right. It will take Barclay and McCaskill to show these Noon Creek geezers what dancing is. McCaskill and Barclay, I set him straight. But you're correct enough other than that. See if our fiddler George can play Tam Lin, Rob, while I tend to the rest. Apprehensively, Rob's wife, Judith, began. Now, you two. No, love, it's we three. You're into this, too, said Rob. And whoever Angus can inveigle into risking her. I was across the room before my feet knew they were moving. I hadn't a wisp of a clue as to how this person, Anna, would react to a dancing exhibition. Here was the time of times to find out. It's all for the cause of education, of course, I prattled to her while those direct blue eyes worked on me. Instruction for the world at large, think of it as. The smile I wanted began to sidle onto her face. I'll believe you, granted Miss Anna Ramsey, and lightly grasped the arm I proffered. But thousands would not. With Anna gloriously beside me, I hadn't even a qualm about attempting the next impossibility across the room. Sing! Lucas repeated as if I'd asked him to shed all his clothing. Angus, what in goddamn hell? He stoppered that because of Anna's presence. But there still was considerable flame in his next try. Angus, lad, I hate to say that your common sense flew out the hole in your hat, but asking for singing from me. Lucas, you're the only other one of us here who's been to the rascal fair and watched how old Fergus does all this. If Rob and I are going to step out here and show how it's done, in Nethermuir, we need you to sing the tune of it, man. Lucas was shaking his head vehemently when Anna spoke in firm fashion. Mr. Barclay, we in Brechin always heard that the men of Nethermuir are brothers to the lark. That halted his head. Well, yes, I know that was always said. Lucas confirmed without undue modesty. We once in a while even said something of the sort ourselves. Tamlin, did you mention Angus? I'm going to spare you most of the verses of Tamlin. I'm what might generously be called tune-challenged. But to give you some idea of what Lucas is singing, let me kind of recite an occasional one. Just think of it as Scottish rap. Dark and deep lay the wood of night, and eerie was the way, as fair Janet with hair so bright toward Linfield Hall did stray. Angus's voice again. I grant that other nationalities are known to dance, but it is my hypothesis they must have learned how from the Scots. You can't but admit that a land of both John Knox and Robert Burns is nimble. We like to think that quality comes out on us at both ends, head and feet. Earlier that night, I danced a reel with Flora Duff, who was as wide as any other two women there, and Flora moved like a rumor. And now, Rob and Judith and Anna and I were the four-hearted dancer of all dancers, gliding to and from, following the weave of the tune, answering Lucas's unheavenly but solid voice with the melody of ourselves, saluting the night and life with our every motion, capping them all with the time-stopping instant when Rob and I faced one another, each with a hand on a hip and an arm bent high above head, and our two throats as one flung the exultant Highland cry, "Hi-ya!" Lucas, getting down again. About the dead hour of the night, she heard Tam's bridles ring. Her maidenly heart beat with might. Her pulse began to sing. Angus now, dancing up a storm out here. Put away geography and numeration and the presidents from yon to hither, pupils of mine and of my partner in whirl, Anna, and write for us books of that dance. Scissor her lovely profile down the left of your pages, and in eternal ink say how forthright she is even when set to music. Miss Ramsey seems to look into the face of the tune in the air and say, yes, you are what music should be, you should write. Make an exact report of the way she and I blend into a single dancing figure, and then shift swiftly into two again, and next meld with Rob and Judith. You will please find a line somewhere there too, for the heady Scotch heaven serenade this schoolroom has never heard before tonight. Lucas doing the finale. She heard the horseman's silvery call. Come braid your golden hair in the fine manse of Linfield Hall, for I, Tamlin, am there. Hi-ya! Our final whoop, Rob and I agreed, could have been heard by old Fergus the Dervish himself, wherever he was cavorting in Scotland just then. A few more pages pass in the book, and then it comes to this. A recess soon after that, I stepped from my classroom into the mud room for something from my coat. Angus is back at his schoolhouse here during school. The outside door had been left open, and in from the girls' field of play was wafting the clear lilt of Susan Duff. Susan is Angus's prized pupil, the daughter of a Bible-thumping old Scot with a singing voice honed on 1,000 Calvinist hymns. If I live long enough and the creek don't rise, Susan Duff someday will have her own book. But for right now, she's still a schoolgirl singing in the schoolyard. The wind and the wind and the wind blows high. The rain comes scattering through the sky. He is handsome, she is pretty, boy and girl of the golden city. I smiled at all that brought back song of every schoolyard in Scotland. I bent to my coat search and hummed along as Susan sang on. The wind and the wind and the wind blows high. The rain comes scattering through the sky. Anna Ramsey says she'll die if her lover says goodbye. That took care of my humming. What was coming next verse, I could guess all too definitely. The wind and the wind and the wind blows high. The rain comes scattering through the sky. A bottle of wine to tell his name. Angus MacCaskill, there's his fame. I wondered whether everybody on this cheek of the earth knew the future of Anna and me, except the pair of us. Maybe it was time we found out too. Well, that's meant to be some life and weekend fun at one end of our century, just before the turn of the century. Onward to the new. The link is that Angus MacCaskill was the founder of three later generations of MacCaskills who showed up in my other novels, English Creek and Ride With Me, Mariah Montana. The latest member of that family crops up right away in this next book to be. This novel, so far, seems to be about a couple of people of today, roughly this time in our history, perhaps a year ago, perhaps next year, we'll see, but around here somewhere in this calendar of the century. People of today trying to find their way as the earth whirls and occasionally wobbles a little under them, as relationships keep having new names put on them, as jobs go and the internet, etc., comes, and as they become something like the reluctant peanut butter and jelly sandwiched between the generation of their kids and their parents. One name you'll hear just mentioned here, a bit odd, it's Midget, M-I-D-G-E-double-T, perfectly honorable old Scottish name. That sounds a little odd out loud. And so here we go up the coast a bit. Lexa MacCaskill ran both hands through her coppery hair, adding up appetites. Non-wedding for 50, the job slip on the refrigerator door read. But 50, when it came to party food, in her experience, always meant either 40 grazers or 60, depending on whether last-minute lightning strikes of invitations offset the no-shows. Lexa still marveled at how people treated guest lists like poker hands, panicking when their whole card sent regrets and then bluffing wildly to fill out the room. The last occasion she did the catering for, she'd overheard the host introducing his Tai Chi instructor around. Down here, it might be the personal trainer, I guess. So, Lexa thought to herself, if this is one that turns into a cattle call, what do I fill them up with, bunny food or gold-plated grub? Now she remembered that tonight's was a lakefront young bunch whose style was to balance their plates with a dab of this and an atom of that while comparing the latest paraphernalia of their health clubs. Go strong on dip dishes and let them eat their treadmill hearts out if the smoked salmon and the swede balls run short, Lexa decided. Jotting down item by item all the things she had to do today, a habit picked up by osmosis from Mitch, she was restless to head outside. Out the kitchen window, the beaming morning weather was almost enough to make a person forget Seattle's rain blotter reputation. She hoped the sun would hold for Mitch while he flew back up the coast from his environmental conference in Berkeley. He seemed to need all the warming up he could get these days. Whoa, though, she told herself, That sounds dangerously like a wifey, doesn't it? Lexa, at 40, long since had adjusted to a lot of life's double talk, but modern living together still took some tiptoeing through the terms for her. When they started at this, when she and Mitch Rozier swallowed away what they had done to Travis, she, and for that matter Mitch, had to get used to being called a significant other. Then along came the census takers, who slapped on them the information that they had become posselcues, persons of opposite sex in same living quarters. Now, all of a sudden, the expression for what they were to each other seemed to be spousal equivalent, which possibly was one reason Mitch looked so furrowed up lately. It was all enough to make Lexa nostalgic for her sister Mariah's galling remark when given the news about her moving in with Mitch. Finally going to try some shacking up, huh? Getting going on her day, Lexa went into the backyard to the herb bed, started gathering burnet to flavor the vegetable dip. From his garden patch next door, where he was bending over from the waist to stab slugs with a trowel, their landlord Ingvaldson watched her suspiciously. He was possessive of Mitch, and as yet Lexa's presence, now 6 years, was something Ingvaldson preferred not to acknowledge. "Morning, Henry," she called over to him. "Your slug supply holding out okay, or should I send over some of mine?" "Yeah, I got plenty," Ingvaldson said moodily and eviscerated a 6-inch-long banana slug. A bit of a grin twitching, Lexa snipped another dozen stems of burnet while Ingvaldson went back to pretending she was nowhere in sight. There was an ocean between the crabby old fisherman and her, literally. He liked to fill Mitch full of tales of the North Pacific, because Mitch did not know a bowline from a bulkhead. But Lexa most definitely did, having cooked on fish boats out of Sitka and Yakutat and Kodiak. A woman who had trawled farther north than Henry Ingvaldson was always going to be grounds for consternation. Back in the kitchen, Lexa stood thinking, whistling to herself for the company of it, then pulled out her next-to-largest mixing bowl, even though this was on the early side to be fixing the vegetable dip. She had learned, though, that no one at a catered shindig could tell anyway that the dip had been sitting in the refrigerator most of the day, whereas if the carrot sticks tasted more than a minute old, there would be handle choruses of whining. So, stir now, chop later, always a sound policy. Blop, blop. She spooned globs of yogurt and mayo into the big bowl, filled it with judicious sloshes of buttermilk, began to whisk the mixture, her square, rugged hands liking to be doing something. Every so often, she caught one of her customers staring at these hands, attention caught on the glaring white swaths of scar all the way across the base of both palms. In the territory of suicide try, yet not quite on target across the wrists, which caused the uncertainty in those stares. Barbed wire was responsible, she never bothered to tell the customers. She had been straining on the wire stretcher, one last notch, her father rummaging in the Dodge Power Wagon they used for fixing fence, when he thought to call out, "Hey, I think that's about enough," but the barbed wire already snapping with a murderous twang, sharp metal whipping across the bottoms of her clenched hands. The next thing she knew was the white face of her father as he tore apart a grease gun and globbed grease onto her slashes to stop the flowing blood. She was 13 then, and, scarred for life, was mad only that she would have to forfeit the entry money for her and her mare Mud in the barrel race at the rodeo the next week. Up from those hard-used hands, Alexandra Marie McCaskill, married name Lexa Midget, she knew that last name was not Travis's fault, but it hadn't helped any. Lexa was what her parents' generation liked to term presentable, and she herself had always calculated out as no more than a C+. To start with the plus side, there was the family flag of the McCaskills, their hair, an enviable royal rich red mane on her sister Mariah, a shading toward burnished copper in Lexa's pageboy cut. Another McCaskill attribute, though, Lexa could have done with less of. The expansive upper lip, which must have come from generation after generation of ancestors' pursed expressions at their circumstances back in stony Scotland. The handsome gray eyes of that musing clan had not come down to her either, or had not come down to her, only a faded sea color. Face a bit too square, nose a bit saucy, it all added up to what Lexa ruefully knew was a permanent kid sister look, which had not been made any easier by growing up alongside Mariah, who had the power to cloud men's minds. The pair of sisters weren't even in the same contest on figure. Mariah, lanky and shouldery as the McCaskill men had been, while Lexa was more sturdily consigned to their mother's side of the family, chesty and puckish. So far, Lexa had managed to stay a few judicious pounds away from stocky, even though, to Mitch's constant wonderment, she tended to eat whatever presented itself, including, now, a contemplative tablespoon of vegetable dip at 8 a.m. She tried to figure out why it tasted so blah. Right, whiz-bang chef, it came to her. Remember the trip into the backyard? She cut the frilly shamrock leaves of the burnet off the stems, minced the tiny pile with a butcher knife, then stirred their green flax mightily into the bowl of dip, the better to have the catered to ask tonight, "Ooh, what gives it that cucumbery taste?" After stowing the dip on the bottom shelf of the crammed refrigerator, she consulted its door again. The thicket of cartoons, stickets, snapshots, and other clutter there that served as the almanac, calendar, album, and footnotes of life in this household. Nibbling her lip, Lexa arranged today's stuck-on chores down the door in the order she ought to get to them. Pick up smoked salmon and salad makings, prepare the meatballs, prepare the veggies, prepare Mitch, for that matter. Her regular pourer, Brad, who like 3/4 of the males in Seattle dreamed of making his living by playing music, rarely got gigs, but Brad had one tonight. So Mitch did not know it yet, but he was going to have to bartend. From Lex's point of view, he was perfectly fitted to be a bartender since he didn't indulge in alcohol, but Mitch never liked taking orders, even if it was only a little white wine, please. And tonight's catering job was way over east of Lake Washington, in the land of software that Mitch called Siberia. So that was not going to be popular with him either. Could be quite a night in catering history, she warned herself. It about blew her mind sometimes, the long arithmetic of chance that had delivered her here, to this, to life with him. Her father would have said she took the uphill way around. But a day at a time, sometimes lately, minute to minute, she and Mitch had been sorting it out, right from the morning when it occurred to both of them that her stay under this roof seemed to be more than temporary. Frowning, she did one last inventory of the notes, thick as shingles on the refrigerator door, peeled off the one that read, "Mitch, Wednesday, Friday, Berkeley Conference, Hotel Durant, then San Francisco Jocelyn," wondering how that went last night, his get-together with his daughter, the prickly pear. And now, that scene. People who get their news from Doonesbury, this Halloween refugee who, as his grown daughter, made fun of him. Mitch had to hope it was fun as the pair of them put on blades. What happens when you and Lexa run out of refrigerator magnets? Boopsie will have a website by then, Mitch said, trying to catch up as Jocelyn began to coast on her rollerblades. Around them, the horde on wheels kept thickening as more skaters pumped across the Embarcadero and glissaded onto the sidewalk in front of the ferry building. Several hundred, Friday-nighted to their pierced eyebrows and gaudy fingernails, already had congregated beneath the building's clock tower, were milling around in various states of balance like a ballet school having a costume party. "How rav and dressed for excess," sang this tribe of recreational outlaws. In khaki slacks and rental black knee pads and a messageless yellow t-shirt, Mitch felt next thing to naked. One or another of Jocelyn's hues, orange tank top, chartreuse leotards, knee pads painted a disturbing fleshy pink. Flared in the corner of his vision as he and she rode their skates around the clumps of waiting bladers. Not that he couldn't have kept track of Jocelyn just by the way she jangled. Wherever Jocelyn got her fashion news from, it dictated a wristwatch with an industrial strength expansion band, deliberately too big so it slid up and down her arm. At her wrist, she wore a bracelet made out of what seemed to be links of old tire chain to blockade the watch from flying off. Time, slithering back and forth, clinking and clanking ominously, Mitch did not need to be reminded of. Whatever, said Jocelyn. Advertising and I are over. I'm jacked on marketing now. Jocelyn drawled her way back to where they'd been in the conversation before he brought down on himself that accusation of hopeless Dunes burial. On himself and Lexa, which doubly smarted, so much for nonchalantly reporting on your current household partner to the child of your ex-wife's spiteful loins. All he'd done was confess he had never heard of Jocelyn's latest employer, something called Juice Up. Then stepped in it deeper by asking if she'd written any juicy ads lately. Juice Ups are freestanding health drink kiosks, she severely recited for his benefit, although he still couldn't tell whether this mantra was advertising or marketing. They're like a Starbucks out on the sidewalk, only citrus. Hey, really, you've never tried one? I don't want to seem anti-citrus or anything, Mitch said, but we're rolling, someone bellowed an echo of the tower clock's first deep note, and by its eighth chime, were they ever. In one single accelerating commotion, the massed rollerbladers let themselves loose, each of them a polymer marble in the spill that rolled toward Fisherman's Wharf. Tourists in rental cars wildly pulled over at the sight of this meteor shower of get-ups. The closets of San Francisco airborne on low-flying naiads and maskers, leftover wavy gravies and incipient Courtney loves, retro flappers, bare midriff bodybuilders in stark spandex, seasoned exhibitionists and hard-in-throat first-timers alike, born on boots, speedy as runaway midget locomotives. Skating the rim of the city, the rolling multitude hung a left at Bay Street and aimed its thundering wheels toward Fort Mason. Carefully matching Jocelyn stride for stride somewhere near the middle of the throng, finding the side-to-side push and glide rhythm of the exercise laps he'd lately been taking on skates, Mitch one more time told himself to quit worrying. Hadn't he biked across Iowa, kayaked Glacier Bay? As much of Mitch as there was, and he's a former Pacific Coast Conference football player, third stringer, but all conference scholastically. As much of Mitch as there was, he needed to keep fit or watch himself inflate enough to leave the earth. So, when he called Jocelyn about getting together before he flew home and she pleaded this weekly habit of skimming through the city, grooved San Franciscan that she was after a half year here, he had been able to say he did some rollerblading too, a time or two anyway. That'll work, she replied, which it had taken him a moment to decipher as an invitation or a challenge. And now they were on the long straight glide past the marina, where necklaces of lights out in the bay showed off the Golden Gate Bridge, when from nowhere a bare-shouldered young man in salmon-covered overalls scooted up between Jocelyn and Mitch. Asian lithe and American friction-free, he seemed paused even as the three of them rocketed along side by side by side. Primo outfit, Joss, he yelled above the chunga-chunga-chunga sound of urethane wheels. Appraising Mitch and their family resemblance, he gave Jocelyn a knowing look, left the advice, be your blades, and sped ahead like a breakaway hockey player. Of the next many minutes of pushing and gliding, pumping and striding, Mitch later could summon up the amplified wail of a sidewalk singer at the corner of Marina and Divisadero, unsuccessfully bombarding the whizzing procession with, Jesus is the way, the truth, and the light. And then only a blur as the skating swarm honed in on the Palace of Fine Arts, 100 bladers at a time peeling into its rotunda, joining hands to form a whirling roller snake there between the fancy chocolate dome. Mitch finding himself holding hands with a character who had a kazoo in his mouth, letting out bleats like a dwarf foghorn as the merry-go-round of skaters spun under the dome. Then, centrifuged out to the arches around the rim of the rotunda, Mitch propped gratefully beside other bladers catching their breath. In his case, there was a lot of breath to catch. As bottled water popped into every set of hands, Jocelyn chugging down copious slugs of hers. "Eat your heart out, juice up," registered on Mitch. Before the final 6 miles through this lovely, mischievous city, which from Lombard Street onward was, God help the beginning rollerblader, a labyrinth of hills. Ahead of Mitch as they made the turn off Lombard, the little red reflectors on the back of skaters' helmets straggled up, up, up in the night like Christmas lights strung too thin. A vast apprehension sucked into Mitch. The conference he'd been covering in Berkeley was called Thinking Like a Mountain, the Place of Nature in a New Millennium. If Mitch thought like the ski slope street rearing in front of him at this instant, the mental result would be a hideous subterranean giggle at how much trouble humankind still had with uphill. While he clambered at the slope in imitation of Jocelyn's short digging strides, what he tried not to think about, what he tried, was how many times his pounding heart had already beat in 50 years. Huffing and puffing, he floundered to a halt at the first plateau of intersection when Jocelyn called over to him, "Ready to skitch?" When a bread truck came laboring up the street, she grabbed onto the rear bumper, Mitch gingerly following suit, each sitting back on their skates for the hitchhike up the hill. They passed San Francisco row houses of all pastel flavors, the corner of every block given over to coin laundries or tiny restaurants with prices more savage than panthers. Oh, San Francisco, dear and doomed, stacked so prettily on tectonic fracture. Mitch knew he ought to be writing in his head, tucking away fragments for use when he did the piece about the Berkeley conference. But clinging to a truck bumper took a surprising amount of concentration. At the top lay Broadway, at least it's Baghdad by the Pacific version, and a sane few level blocks before the route crouched and dived underground. The Broadway tunnel, a third of a mile of amplified skate wheel sounds and infinitely repeated tiny yellow tiles, not to mention unamused car traffic, disoriented Mitch a bit. It was like being subjected to hearing and eyesight tests while trying to waltz. Yee-hoo! Halfway through this treacherous echo chamber, the shriek Jocelyn let out scared him half to death. Lurching to look around at her, Mitch was met with a moon of grin that informed him her whoop had been for the absolute ki-yi kick of it. Right, drive another stake into old dad. He managed a pale smile back at her and floundered into stride again as she shot along ahead of him. Pleased as a Comanche who had just counted coup, she nonetheless did look like a hurtling pumpkin in that orange tank top. Once more, Mitch felt an obscure genealogical guilt that instead of Marnie's fine bone features, Jocelyn had been handed his bulk. Other than that, the only gene this father and daughter seemed to share was the shape of a rollerblade wheel. They swooped out of the tunnel into a garlic precinct of North Beach. "Hey, wait." Breathing heavily, very heavily, Mitch managed to halt Jocelyn at the first street corner. Let's watch a minute." "You like to watch?" Jocelyn said in insinuating imitation, but stayed next to him, turning in restless circles. Skaters shot out of the tunnel in platoons, Mitch saw, a sorting of some kind occurring for this passage. Here came pairs of women in shimmy dresses holding hands, and now men in sequins line dancing. And next the half-Asian young Nureyev in overalls again, impossibly coasting sideways. Even more impossibly, each foot pointing in opposite direction in line with his spread eagle arms, a human parallelogram from shoulder blades down to rollerblades as he drifted by like a beautiful winged statue passing. "Go ninja, Joss," the flat, knee-bent form of him called out as it cruised around their corner in an effortless lean, set sail through Chinatown for Union Square, and stretch turned toward the ferry building. As further skating contingents erupted from the tunnel like circus acts, Jocelyn gradually stopped twirling on her blades and settled into watching beside Mitch. Knowing better, he still couldn't help seizing the moment as a hope, maybe, that she was putting away the arsenal of resentment. This made twice that he and she had got together this year. He would need to think all the way back to be sure, but twice seemed to him a new record in the 20 years since Marnie had catapulted herself and the kids to Key West. "Why'd you stop there?" Mitch had howled down thousands of miles of phone line at her. "Wouldn't they let you behind the barbed wire at Guantanamo?" Before that, there had been a determined try at split custody, but it turned out to be cruelty to small creatures. The bewildered kids never with either him or Marnie long enough to know when their next Betty Bye would take place. And so Mitch, knowing he would be condemned, but quite used to it from life with Marnie, gave over daughter and son to her, and away she went with them as far as she could, still have the U.S. Mail deliver child support checks. Parked on her blades next to Mitch, Jocelyn eyed him, wondering why he felt he had to do this, make like he wanted to connect after all this time. "You're some late, Dad Space. You and Mom's made your choice way back there. And now I'm supposed to what? Say no prob? I never did want a father around anyhow. Mom's those hairball sailboarders did just fine." But cool as she tried to be, she kept noticing his sopping wet t-shirt, the sheen of sweat rolling down out of his curly black hair, the seismic rise and fall of his chest. He looked buff enough for his age, but taking some more time here on the corner probably wouldn't hurt. She didn't want him going dead in the midst of this. She did not want that. He heard Jocelyn rattle a little beside him. "Joss," the kid in overalls called her. What, Mitch wondered now, had he and Marnie been thinking of when they picked a name as breakable as Jocelyn? But it wasn't nicknames that nicked a family to death, was it? He closed his eyes a moment against the record of domestic misadventure brought west to him again with Jocelyn's move out here to his own coast. Bad tempers and worse size, Marnie's toy store of a brain versus his infatuation with whatever story he was working on that week. The mattress, the only surface in the house they paid any attention to. The two kids too soon. He could read it off like an old traffic ticket, speeding into marriage while under the influence.
Ends with some pretty strong words. Something ambushes all hopes. I mean, something goes wrong with all these projects. What is that something? What is unraveling? We were just talking about the threads that tie these people together.
Yeah.
What pulls them apart or pulls things apart? Center cannot hold.
Bucking the Sun had drawn me because of what I saw as the moral complications of damming the Missouri River. The Fort Peck Dam was, I think it has to be said, a very successful New Deal project. And it took place for perfectly understandable reasons. That there was a northern dust bowl up there. People had been droughted out, grasshoppered out, whatever. Jobs, money of any kind was desperately needed. And out of one of the political alliances of the time, the Montana senior senator, Burton K. Wheeler, whose vote was badly needed by Roosevelt in the New Deal things, came this dam with more than 10,000 jobs. And, you know, we're still trying to fight the lack of job situation today. So it was starker and simpler, I think, back then. Jobs came, the Missouri River Valley for 135 miles went underwater. We can't say forever because we don't know that dams are going to last forever. But many people making a pretty good living in bottomland farming, the historical route of Lewis and Clark across that section, the environmental, the ecological changes, all that went too. And so that was the original notion, Alex, that I wanted to try to deal with. Mm-hmm. And then I got to looking again can't get over grad school, looking at the timing, they no sooner got Fort Peck pretty much built in 38 than, as I discovered as I was writing the book, the Munich crisis is going on at the same time. And I had talked with people, I got much of the idea for this novel from talking with people who had worked on the dam in Montana, and some of them could remember sitting up nights listening to Kaltenborn give the news of Munich or whatever. So that occurred in 38. A couple, 3 years after that, many of these people who worked on the dam were somewhere in World War II. They were somewhere here on the coast, here, the Portland shipyards, the Boeing assembly line in Seattle or whatever, Phoenix. Their lives had changed out of this massive event waiting just beyond the horizon of the dam. And so the ambush of hopes for that generation, it wasn't for all of them, I hasten to say. Some of them got their start there, but it felt to me like there was a massive ambush of hopes, and it had gone back politically into the character of Darius Duff, who had hoped for a kind of a workers' republic along the River Clyde, and some of the other characters also sees things crash and burn. Mm-hmm. It happens.
I had one more question, then we'll open it up. You write about the Old West as a richly interwoven community, and I wondered if you could sort of, and also you write about how a lot of Western writers are quite contrary to what we think of as the diehard types and out there on the OK Corral. Another line, just a quote from a book review that Ivan did for us, it was about Wallace Stegner. One kinship, Ivan said, I have always felt with Wallace Stegner is a square-built Western kid sort, that although we are both descendants of a West of hellraisers, we ruefully recognize ourselves as at most born to raise heck. And I wonder, you know, if you could just, taking up from that cue, could you disabuse us of the notion that Montana is a land of free men and unibombers, yeah, and lone cowboys?
Yeah, so I had, it's about a year ago, I guess, that the unibomber and Freeman news was hitting the story, hitting the news simultaneously. I was gearing up for the bookstore tour for Bucking the Sun, and so I knew I was going to be asked about this at every juncture. And so I went to the maps, and so when they would ask me in Chicago, well, what about Montana full of all this? And I would point out that the geography of Montana, Montana would extend from Chicago to Annapolis. And so if the Freeman had shown up somewhere around Wheeling, West Virginia, and the Unabomber out here in Skokie, you know, would you be asking me, well, what got into the water of the Great Lakes or whatever? The geographic expanse was really quite considerable there. Richard White, the leading New West historian, did his presidential talk to the Western History Association this year on what do we make of the recent weirdness in the West? And he linked some of it, of course, to the politics of the moment. I think there has been quite a lot of that. Various things, I believe, have caused this. Certainly a place such as the Freeman were, or for that matter, the Unabomber suspect. You know, if you want isolated places to practice your firearms, why, those are pretty good places to go to. And so Montana still is full of those. But Montana's had a long history of quite liberal politics, electing liberal Democratic senators in the past. And so, and it's full now of, you know, lone eagles with their cell phones and so forth who, you know, are intent on improving the schools and getting potholes out of the roads and so on. I've always kicked against really the Hollywood myth of the West, and I include in that the books of Louis L'Amour. You know, it has not been very long ago that the images of the West were those two guys, Louis L'Amour and John Wayne. And you look around the West, and you see some guys like that with the 25 pounds of with the pound of belt buckle holding up the 25 pounds of extra there. But a lot of that has given way as it had to. So places like Montana really have many of the concerns the rest of the country does. You know, how do we educate people? How do we keep the infrastructure going?
All disparate kinds of people hidden in those beautiful valleys.
Yes.
Well, questions from the audience. Anyone have any questions for Ivan? Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes. The gentleman is alluding to White Sulphur Springs, Montana, the area. Area I wrote about in this House of Sky, the area I was born into, and the little town of Ringling, which indeed was named after John Ringling. That has been something I think that kind of comes into my writing, is this feeling of having grown up in sort of the baronial West. John Ringling owned much of the county that I grew up in, and my grandparents milk cows for the Ringling family, and so I have kind of kept an eye peeled on this. You know, is the West going to turn into Georgian England, where where the big rich live on estates and everybody else gets to dress colorfully and do the chores?
How?
It made for an interesting moment a few months ago when phone rang, and it was the Cable Television Association, I guess, wanting me to sign up some books for Ted Turner, which I did. But in one of those books, Mariah Montana, is a passage by, of course, I lay it off on my newspaper character. You know, newspapermen can get away with anything. But he has done a kind of a screed in there as to how you can get by in Montana. It's best to own, say, a cable TV network or a pro football team.
Is the whole notion of, the West a completely artificial construct in a way? Because I'm thinking of the rollerbladers zipping, whizzing by you in San Francisco, or we just heard, or those with the belt buckles the size of car radiators. What are there ties that bind?
Well, I think there are. I hearken quite a bit to Richard White, whom I know, and we talk about some of this stuff. And you ask Richard some of this, and he'll often say, "Well, we're not Easterners."
<You know? laughs> What does that mean?
and that is a commonality, I think. But the entire the Western historians, I think, have always had the problem of defining what is the West. Sometimes they simply take the Mississippi River and use everything this size of it. But it is, of course, very complicated, and that's, I think, what has made it one of the hot topics in academic history today. How do you deal with the fact that Los Angeles probably is the capital of the West? What people do here, whether they move in, out, or whatever, it tends to set up these pinball movements through the rest of the West. And so the New West historians, such as White and Patricia Nelson Limerick and William Cronin, their eyes, on the one hand, it's as complicated as hell to try to figure out, but their eyes absolutely light up. They find it a great time to be historians. I think it's a good time to be a writer out here, too, that the cowboys and the cows are pretty much behind us in the West now. And so we can look at something like, why do people rollerblade through San Francisco every Friday night in a whole stampede?
Well, there, Ivan has brilliantly, we'll open up for a couple more questions and we'll have to wrap up because Ivan has another engagement, but written beautifully about, as I said, the ties that bind people and about community. But I just sort of wanted to to see whether you would agree that there's any truth at all to the notion that there is something more individual about the West. I mean, after all, we turned this desert into a dream for a few years, at least called L.A., and it was built on the brilliant or crazy fantasies of certain individual people, unlike, say, the East Coast, where you have, as you said, states and baronial lineages that go back eons. And is it fair to make that generalization, that there is something a little more individualistic or independent-minded? Or
Alex, I think we believe that, and that belief in itself becomes a kind of an entity of the West. There's probably some actuality behind it because of the bigger stage geographically out here. My wife and I have had the experience on earlier California trips of driving down through California, listening books on tape to 2 years before the mast, the Richard Henry Dana story of being in the cowhide trade out here early in the 19th century. There's no Los Angeles to speak of. I don't think there's any San Diego, and so on. And you know, you listen to something like that, and then, you know, count on your fingers the decades or whatever, you think something's happened, sure as hell. But a lot of it happened because of transcontinental railroads, because of the land system set up, and so on. So I tend to think that it's the stage, the landscape, the immensity of the distances out here that that have made all this show up. I mean, I'm sure the Florida Keys are full of individuals, so, you know, people so individual we think they're absolutely crazy. But they're dotted around here, can't see them in the national myth, national news, or in the national travel. Part of what people think of the West is the fact that it has been accessible. Many people have been through California for one reason or another. They came here because they were in the service. Relatives moved here. And so people have at least a half notion of the West. And yeah, within that, they see lives and history that seem to them more individual. And so, you know, that tends to skew how things actually are, I believe.
I would think that if you're one of the old Scottish characters in Ivan's novels, and there you walk down the street and the buildings are centuries older than you are, you might feel just a little smaller than if you're Owen Duff, the civil engineer who's just made this huge dam, or if you're the Chandlers or some of other people who've been seminal in building L.A.
Yeah.
Might get to your head a little.
Yes, I think so. I read a lot of homesteaders' letters and British Isle Leavers' letters, at least, for Dancing at the Rascal Fair and on into the Two Medicine trilogy. And there's a terrific sense, I think, Alex, of coping with the immensity that they find out here. It may be the immensity of the loneliness of, people ended up in these homestead shanties or whatever, but things were just on such a bigger scale than, say, a Scottish fishing village where your people had lived all those years, all those centuries maybe.
Well, Mr. Doig has to gallop off to Pasadena, but first, any other questions over there?
Two more. Yes. Well, very good. Very good. Shelby, against whom I played football and got creamed regularly.
Uh-oh. And over there?
Yeah, how is your literature, how are you accepted in the East? And do you think that the Eastern literary establishment is accepting of Western writers, not just as a regional literature, but as a national literature, like
You know,
we should ask whether Western writers are respected now and recognized by the Eastern establishment.
Yeah. You know, I think it kind of comes and goes. My books are reviewed in the East. I would say almost on a par with the reviews that come in the West in terms of, you know, simply being in the paper. The New York Times has been a bit flaky, but then it apparently is with everybody. The Washington Post has always paid good, large attention. I'm sent on book tours to Vermont and Connecticut, and one of the best book signings I ever do is in downtown Washington, D.C., where indeed displaced Westerners who are working somewhere in the government, you know, line up.
A lot of them, yeah.
Line up out onto the mall or whatever. I think what Western writing has lacked in attention, and this may be true of other regional writing, except the Southerners, who somehow get a free pass out of this, and they probably owe it all to Faulkner, and you know, so be it. But it seems to me that any writing that is based in its pages on the region, I mean, it's what we work with, you know, as Joyce worked with Dublin, it's what we know. I don't think that has the academic critics out there who are looking at that sort of thing currently. I think it was the San Francisco Examiner when Stegner died. One of the reporters there had been quite a fan of Stegner, and so she started through the computer databases to see how much attention was being paid to him. And I think there were four or five theses or dissertations on all of Stegner's career at that point. Well, you know, that's kind of ludicrous in a sense, that there isn't more scholarship being done. And the way it may reverse somewhere, somewhat out here, is the attention, scholarly attention being paid to the Native American writers, Louise Erdrich, Jim Welch, probably Sherman Alexie, and so forth. And so it may be through those writers that the real scholarly attention will come. But in terms of people parsing through my books and asking, you know, well, where did he get this Scottish stuff? What's the New Deal doing in this Son of a Sheepherder's book? So far, they're not smart enough to be asking those questions. One or two more.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.